The following Dharma talk was presented at Common Ground Meditation Center, Minneapolis, Minnesota, as part of the monthly Guest Dharma series.
I think we're all looking forward to Rini speaking, and many of us have read on the Caring Bridge website some of the postings from Rini and also from Ben, her partner, about just bringing awareness to this wildlife that we have, and especially in Rini's case, she discovered she had a very serious endocrine cancer in her liver in June, so about 6 months ago, and just dealing both with her own experience of uncertainty, but also the bureaucratic medical system and all the changes that entails. So if you don't know, Rini is the chair of Common Ground's board of directors and a longtime community member and practitioner and a dear friend for many of us. I really appreciate that you're willing to be here tonight, Rini, to share your practice with us. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Mark. Wow. Look at all of you. Wow. You can see why we need a new building, huh? Mm-hmm. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
Okay. Wow. Thank you for coming out in the cold. Spend your Saturday night with me and all of us. Especially at the end of such an amazing week, huh? I still can't believe it. Anyway. It's a little daunting, actually, to give my little talk after all the kind of epic sweeps of this week's events. So I was thinking I'd just play a tape of my talk. It's a lip sync. No, actually, I'm just gonna plunge in and try to do it as unapologetically as possible. Oh, it's really wonderful to see you all. And I want to thank Mark for inviting me to give this talk. It's really been a wonderful opportunity to reflect on this in a different sort of way. And I've been reflecting on it all along, but just to kind of step back and look at it as a whole thing. So thank you, Mark. I brought a friend. This is my old friend, Chaos. I'll tell you about him in a little bit, but you can just kind of keep an eye on things for the moment. And the title of this talk is Deep in the Forest of Vicissitudes, Lessons of an Uncertain Life. And I want to give proper credit for that phrase, Forest of Vicissitudes. I really wish I'd come up with it, but I didn't. It actually came from a talk that Kamala Masters gave at one of the summer retreats several years ago. So I should have had quotes around that in the title. Anyway, I'll be talking tonight about my wanderings in that forest and about how meditation practice has been part of that journey. I just can't imagine going through this without that. So I'm going to tell you a story. It's called Rini Has Inoperable Cancer, or We're Not in Moundsview Anymore, Chaos. As I was preparing this talk, I actually had this whole other idea of the direction I was going to go in, and I was going to talk about the three refuges and a bunch of other stuff, but I kept coming back to that image of the forest of vicissitudes and kind of the scary walk through the woods. And I kept hearing lions and tigers and bears, oh my! Or the Buddhist version, which is aging and sickness and death, oh my! So I finally decided to just kind of go with it. Just go with the Wizard of Oz thing. I don't know. Because it might seem like kind of a dusty old story, but I think it has some real archetypal power. Just that idea of being lost in the woods seems to resonate on some kind of primal level for us, just judging from how many stories there are that deal with that in some way. Yeah. I'm sure somebody's done a Buddhist reading of the Wizard of Oz, but I've never seen one. But the more I kept thinking about it, the more it almost seems like a Buddhist parable. I mean, there's the path, obviously, the yellow brick path, and then there's the Emerald City with its false promise and that, you know, that fervent belief that we all have that there's something out there, something outside of us that can make it all okay, can save us, you know. If I only had a brain. If I only had a job or a better job or a cup of coffee or whatever it is, you know. If we only had a better president. Oh, wait. I keep forgetting. Oh, now we're really in trouble, right? Yeah. So there's all that, all those if-onlys. And then there are all the encounters along the way, which you can see either as external forces or as aspects of the personality, the good and the wicked, the helpful and the dangerous, and all the pleasant and unpleasant encounters we have. And then there's the getting distracted and falling asleep along the way, and there's the exposure of the man behind the curtain, the ego, madly manipulating the levers to try to make itself appear great and powerful or sweet and pious or brilliant and talented or whatever her thing is. And then, of course, there's the recognition in the end that what we've been searching for has been with us all along, right here in this moment, right in our own backyard. So, obviously, my story is pretty different from Dorothy's. I'm not going to try to stuff mine into hers, but I find hers instructive, so I'm going to kind of use it as a lens for looking at mine. And the first part of my story, like hers, has to do with the Twister. Getting plucked out of my former life and just thrown down in this alien place where nothing makes sense and the rules keep changing and the ground keeps shifting. How I went to work one Monday morning, left after lunch for a doctor's appointment, saying I'd be back in a couple of hours. And I never returned. I mean, I literally never set foot in that building again. And now it's shut down. Not because I'm not there. But maybe I should move this away from me, huh? But because they shut the whole division down, so yeah, it's like that whole life just went gone. Yeah. So if it seems like I'm spending a long time talking about the first couple of weeks, it's because they really set the tone for everything that's happened since then. Yeah, it all started mundanely enough last spring with stomach pain. I've had just sort of chronic digestive trouble for years, and so this wasn't exactly new, and it would flare up sometimes and get really bad, but this was the most acute it had ever been. And it had gotten to the point where I was just, it was waking me up at night and keeping me awake. Just this really intense, gnawing pain. And you know how it is when something hurts and you kind of start to poke at it? So I was doing that and I discovered this thing, this sort of lumpish, largish thing. And I thought, well, that's weird. Was that always like that? I don't know. I wasn't sure. But I finally decided to go to the doctor. I didn't have insurance at that point, so I tried not to have to go to the doctor. But I really wanted this pain to go away. So I went to the clinic and told her about the pain and went through the exam. And I said, you know, I've got this, almost as an afterthought, I've got this weird thing here. Does this seem weird to you? And she went, And I said, isn't that where the liver is? And she said, Yeah, which was troubling to me. And she said she wanted me to get some imaging done and that I should call Abbott on Monday and arrange to go to the clinic there and they would take care of the CAT scan and all that. So this was Friday afternoon, and Sunday was the May Day parade. And Ben and I were planning to go to the parade. Ben, my Corazon. And I guess I had some inkling at that point, I don't know. But I remember saying to him, I don't know if I want to go. I feel like a corpse walking around. This is kind of the foreshadowing part of the story. So, and he said, well, don't you think the May Day parade needs a corpse walking around? So we went and had a great time, and I have this photograph from that day of the two of us, and I'm laughing and he's looking like Ernest Hemingway, and I look at that and I think, wow, that was the last day of that life. So yeah, on Monday, went to work, actually managed to get an appointment that afternoon at Abbott, and went there, and the doctor spent a really long time with me, maybe 2 hours. I don't think I've ever had a doctor spend that much time with me. And very thorough history and exam, and told him about the pain, told him about the thing, whatever it was. And somewhere in the course of this exam, he goes, is there a history of aortic aneurysm in your family? I'm like, no. What? I have this pain in my stomach. So anyway, he brings another doctor in. He's in all of a sudden we're talking about aortic aneurysm, and I'm starting to get really freaked out. And yeah, they wanted me to get a CAT scan that day, and so I went over to the other part of the hospital where they do that, and by this time it's like late afternoon, and I'm really wishing I hadn't come to this by myself, but somehow I thought things would not happen so quickly. I mean, you sort of think you're going to have an appointment, and then the next 2 days later you have a CAT scan, and then a week later you get the results. But anyway, yeah, it was all happening pretty fast. And so I'm sitting there drinking the whatever it is, contrast dye, which takes hours, and I'm in the little gown thing, which, what is it about those gowns? It's like they're made of kryptonite or something. I mean, you put it on and you're powerless, you know?
Yeah.
So, and I couldn't get a hold of Ben, and I called my sister in Baltimore and completely freaked her out. And I was feeling like kind of a baby for wanting somebody with me, but I finally called my friend Margie, and bless her, she came right over and sat with me. Thank God, because I'm really glad I wasn't alone for this part of the ride. So I sat there for several more hours. I don't know, it's like 9 o'clock at night, I haven't eaten. I keep having these things where I'm just shaking. Are you cold? No. Finally, they send down this teenage doctor. I swear this guy was like 17. Poor boy, he had clearly drawn the short straw. Really bad for him. He sits down and he's kind of like, can't quite look at me, you know. Well, your aorta is fine. I'm like, oh, thank God. You know, I mean, jeez. I was really worried about that. Well, there are some abnormalities. And he said it so surreal. But he said that there are 15 to 20 tumors in my liver, and that the radiologist thinks they're malignant. I don't remember most of the rest of what he said, but he kind of said, good luck. And he sort of, he gave me a prescription for anti-anxiety drugs, and he left. Poor guy. And Margie and I just sat there and kind of stared at the place where he'd been sitting, you know. And then she said, that was a dream, right? Yeah, I think so. Let's go. So we're leaving the hospital, and she grabs my hand and says, let's not tell anyone. It'll be our little secret. And it's like that. It's like when the only thing between you and your former life and whatever the hell this is, it's these words. It's like if you just don't say them, you know, it won't happen. It isn't true. But of course we did say them. And I went and told Ben, and he cooked some eggs for me, which tasted fantastic. And then we were gonna go back to my place for the night. And so he's trying to pack his, you know, just bring whatever he needs. And he would go like stand in the living room and just stand there. And then he'd go in the kitchen and stand in there. And in the bedroom. me when he said, I feel like I'm going on a long trip and I don't know what I'm going to need, you know. And we finally managed to get in the car and we're driving to my place and he turns to me and says, well, I brought 2 bananas. So that's good. You won't be hungry. It's like that moment that stops the mind, you know. You just can't quite. Cerebral function kind of shuts down. And that whole first week was like that. My sister flew in, and Ben's daughter flew in, and my son was here, and a few people came by, and we were just idiots. I mean, we'd like try to play Scrabble, and we couldn't make a word, the bunch of us put together. We laughed a lot, and meanwhile I had all these doctor's appointments, and the doctors were kind of speaking to me in hushed tones, and I mean, it was very clear that they thought this was maybe weeks that we were talking about. And I was, should I be looking into hospice? And I don't know. And somewhere in there, Ben said, nothing to do now but love. And that's kind of echoed through this whole time, you know. There was a real falling away of all the extraneous bullshit that we spend so much time worrying about. And it was beautiful. It was so pure. And I kind of look back on that week as there's sort of this glow around it, because it was just so simple. But then the next week we got the biopsy results and everything changed again. We walk into the clinic and everybody's like beaming. And what? And they tell me that I have neuroendocrine cancer, which apparently is so rare that, what, they didn't even think of that when they saw my CAT scan? I guess not. And it's got a completely different profile and prognosis. And I'm like, wait, what? I'm sorry, I'm really confused. You mean I'm not going to die next week? It doesn't look like it. Okay, well, good, but when am I going to die? Am I going to die from this? And they don't know. They said that I would see the oncologist next week. They'd actually never seen this cancer. Read about it. You know, medical school, but. So, I kind of felt like somebody went, bang, you're dead, you know, and just kidding. And I was really happy to have more time, but I was kind of pissed too, you know. It's kind of like, well, I don't know. It was all so simple when I was about to die. Oh, right, now I have to go on living with this. So that's pretty much the way the pattern has been ever since. One minute, things seem okay, and actually life is really sweet, and yeah, there's a lot of joy and beauty, and I don't feel great, but, you know, it's livable, and then the next minute, here come the flying monkeys, and just take me down. Yeah. For the first I don't know, 6 or 7 months, I kept looking for someplace solid to stand, you know, trying to figure it out. And what I really wanted was for somebody to tell me when I'm going to die. And I kept asking them, of course they don't know. And so I would sort of parse every little scrap of information, every conversation with a doctor, to try to find a clear answer to that question. And there just isn't a clear answer. The things that are clear are that the cancer is really quite advanced, and that there just isn't a whole lot they can do about it. There's no curative treatment. There's the treatments that are available to help with the symptoms come with considerable risk and uncertain outcome. And nobody can tell me what the risk-benefit ratio looks like, because there isn't much information about this disease, and there just aren't any numbers really to base decisions on. So here I am in this forest, confusion and sadness and fear. Oh my. I have a whole host of teachers and companions on this road. Just all the kind and wonderful people in my life, many of whom are sitting here. I just can't tell you how grateful I am for all the support I've been blessed to receive during this time. And then all the encounters with external forces and different parts of my personality, the good, the bad, and the ugly. If we had more time, I would I'd tell you more about all of that, but I do want to make special mention of a few of them. Mark talked a little about the bureaucracy, and you want to talk about your flying monkeys, man. That is some scary stuff. I sort of shudder to think about having to deal with any of that. And, some of the other scary, there's a lot of that, just the fear stuff and the various forms of self-recrimination that seem to come up whenever I'm in adversity, and then for balance, there's Dr. He, for one. Dorothy can have her Glinda the Good. I've got Dr. He, my laughing tiger healer, who saves my life every time I see her. But I said I would tell you about chaos, and I want to do that, and then I'm going to kind of wrap this up so we have a little time for discussion. Yeah, chaos is an important part of the story. A few years ago, there was another part of my life when there was a huge upheaval. And I think that really prepared me in many ways for this time. I look back on that era as when my life blew up. And over the course of a couple of years, I really lost everything most everything that I had pinned my identity to. My marriage fell apart. I lost my livelihood. I had an excruciating parting of the ways with my best friend of 25 years. The non-profit retreat center that I had started crashed and burned. And I ended up having to sell the land that I had loved my whole life. And I was living alone in the country, really isolated, just me and my dog. And then my dog died. And that just about did it for me. Probably the closest I've ever come to cashing it in. So during that time, I had this incredibly vivid dream. And it was one of those sort of unusual dreams in that it wasn't fragmentary at all. It kind of arrived as a complete narrative. And in the dream, I have this teacher who's kind of a wizardy old guy. And I never really see his face during the dream. I'm never quite sure I trust him, but he's my teacher. So one day he invites all of us students over to his house for lunch with the proviso that after lunch, one of us is going to be eaten by a tiger. And we're all kind of like, okay. Yeah, sure, as long as it isn't me. So we go to lunch, and it's just beautiful. I mean, his house is beautiful, the big windows and light streaming in, and there are flowers all around, and we're all kind of lounging around on pillows on the floor, you know, reclining, eating this fabulous meal, and the whole time, we're kind of in this big main room, and the whole time the teacher is sitting up on this little platform, and right next to him is this huge, magnificent, bright orange tiger who's asleep. So after lunch, the teacher says, okay, who's it going to be? And we all start looking at each other, whining, you know. It's like, you didn't think you meant it. You can't do that. And he says, well, that was the agreement. How do you want to do this? So I decide, with characteristic valor, that this would be a good time to sneak out and go to the bathroom. Yeah. So I do. I kind of, you know, tiptoe out of the main room, and I go down this little hallway and into the bathroom, and I'm standing there in the bathroom in front of the mirror, thinking about this poor bastard who's going to get eaten by a tiger. And I'm looking at my face, and I'm going, oh, God, what if he went for your face? That would really suck. Just rip your face open. And then I think, well, maybe just take a hand or a foot, you know, and then the teacher will stop him. This is all the way. This is a full meal deal. And then I realize that if the tiger eats you, you become the tiger. So if you love the tiger, it's all good. You just have to love the tiger. So then I feel better, and I go back out, and I just walk back down the hallway, and I'm about to go back into the big room, and the house has gotten really quiet, like everybody fell asleep. And I go, oh, shit. I'm the one. And I'm the one. Not because I snuck out to the bathroom in the dream. I'm the one because I love the tiger. So, and then, I don't know, it's weird. I'm not really afraid. It's like, I just kind of feel like, wow, this is going to be amazing. And then I wake up. So after that, I went out and got myself a tiger and named him Chaos. And oh, I think that's kind of interesting. At that point, I gave the name Chaos to that experience of things falling apart, things not being the way I want them to be, things being the way they are. I don't think I would give him that name anymore. In the closing circle of a retreat I was on time, one of the participants told this really moving story about how he'd always been looking for a home, a place to rest, a place to belong, and that in the course of this retreat he discovered that he always had a place to rest in the breath, that he always had a home in this moment, just as it is. So learning to love the tiger, and I say learning because outside of that dream, this is something I'm learning over and over and over every day. Learning to love the tiger is about learning to love this moment, just as it is, with all the things I wish were different. Sitting right here on this shifting ground with this messed up body and this constricted breath and this tumult of thoughts and emotions, all the fear, doubt, sadness. And all the overflowing love and the outrageous wild beauty of the whole preposterous thing, the whole catastrophe. That's the tiger. That's the only place there is to rest, as far as I can tell. That's home. So So may we all learn to love the tiger. May we all find our way home. There's no place like home. So if anybody feels the need to embrace chaos, I'm happy to send them around. Anybody have any...
Yeah, okay, good.
Hey, he's a good hugger.
I have a question.
Yeah.
So you wouldn't name chaos chaos. Now, what would you name your tiger if you had another tiger?
That's a good question. Well, I have wondered if he's morphing into the laughing tiger. But I think more when I it's so overused, but Dharma is kind of what I was thinking, you know, things as they are. Too bad I got ruined by that silly show. But anyway. Yeah. Anybody have anything in your own life that you want to share, or any comments or questions?
Me? I have a question about the bureaucracy.
Mm.
If you could
maybe talk about how you've handled that, or what were the challenges and how you dealt with it. I don't know if anybody else has seen that. Yeah, boy. That's really been... For a long time, I felt like I was caught in some kind of Kafka nightmare, you know. I applied, I guess, right at the beginning for medical assistance, and it took a full 7, maybe even 8 months before there was any sense of kind of coming to a resolution where I feel like I have medical assistance now. I mean, it was kind of one gigantic disaster after another. You know, I sent in the application and then they would send me something back and say, oh, we didn't get this, and so I, you know, photocopy these things, you know, these stacks of paper and send it to them. Oh, but now we need these, and so do that, so then I send them that, and then you've been canceled, and then, no, now you're reinstated, and but now it's up for renewal before it's even gone into effect, and I mean, really, it's just been unbelievable. And they would, you know, they kept losing. I would send them things and they'd lose them. And then they were just mean. I mean, it was really, you know, it was really amazing to me. And I kept thinking, wow, what must it be like? I mean, this is for... I speak English, you know, and, you know, compared with a lot of people who are doing this, I'm actually in pretty good health. You know, I'm sure many people are in far worse shape who are trying to do this same thing. And I don't know how you do it, because Ben kept reminding me, these are the people who are on the front lines of a broken system, and that's really, that feels really true. You know, they just, it's an impossible situation. And so I kept persisting, you know, I kept sending them the stuff. And then in the meantime, I applied for disability, which in contrast was a breeze. And I'd always heard that that was really difficult. But that, with this diagnosis, I guess it went, it just went through. And once I had that, then medical assistance kind of came around, and I finally figured out, oh, you need to talk to the supervisor, that's the thing. And things kind of, I won't say stabilized, because I still don't trust it. I'm always afraid they're going to cut me off, but yeah.
How about the medical people? Has that been?
I've had really wonderful care. I feel very, very fortunate. Abbott has everyone I've run into there has, almost everyone has been really good. And, you know, it's, the system is maddening no matter what, I think. But I have a really good oncologist who actually listens, and so that's huge. And yeah, I feel like slowly I'm kind of putting together this little team, but I'm just aware of how much you just have to be your own advocate. I have a lot of help, really. I have, yeah. About the lake? Yeah, that lake. Grew up spending my summers on this lake, and it's very much my spiritual home. And the story that I was telling about the time of chaos was when I was living at the lake, something I would have always thought I always wanted to do. It's funny, you get what you want, you know. It was a really painful time, yeah. And that was the place, that land was what I was trying to turn into a peace camp and retreat tender. And so, yeah, that process of losing that land was probably the biggest teaching I've ever had about attachment. I really quite literally thought that I would die, you know, if I had to leave the lake. And interesting, isn't it? And then somewhere in there I let it go, and didn't die, and we, yeah, not then. And then the very next year, a friend of mine who lived on the lake offered me a place on the same lake, a little tiny cabin that I still spend my summers in. And so I really have spent every summer of my life on that lake. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah.
How
How has it made a difference?
Yeah. Well, I think it's really that perspective of helping me recognize that this moment is all I've got. And yeah, I was able to do the year-end retreat this year, which was just a wonderful retreat, and just had a very powerful experience of that. During those 4 days or whatever, that spend so much energy and time fighting the way things are. I mean, even apart from this illness, that's true. You know, I just always kind of wishing something were different, if only. And I think that this practice really has helped me learn, is helping me learn how to accept things just where they are. Yeah, over and over.
I'm curious, it's going on my business, but how, with your son, how are you preparing for, with your relationship, like the letting go, or the, how has that been going for him?
It's been really hard for him. I think, in fact, he was going to be here tonight and just found it too hard.
No. How old is he?
He's 31. We spend a lot of time together. He's been great. He's just such a terrific person and so there for me, you know. And he's kind of taken it on as like this personal mission to help with this laughing every day, that, you know, the smiling, laughing from my Dr. Who. And so we watch a lot of movies together, and he's an artist, and so we spend time kind of talking. We talk a lot about our respective creative processes, and that's just really been great, I think, for both of us, because that's one of the things that I'm doing during this time is really trying to spend some time writing. So he inspires me. But it's a really hard thing to try to prepare for. I don't know. Yeah, please.
I was just wondering if you can, as somebody who has a close person who's just been diagnosed with cancer, can you remember or tell us stories about things people did that gave you some need, that helped, or some kindness?
Yeah, boy, there are so many. I think it has just meant so much to me just to know that people are there. One of the things I'm most grateful for is how generous and patient people have been with my process with this. I feel like people have really let me know that they're there and that the whatever they can do, they will. But they've also given me the space to kind of find my own way with it, and that's been really helpful for me because it's weird. It's been a real source of stress for me, anxiety, really, worrying about other people, you know, worrying about, oh, I need to call somebody back, or, you know, I mean, there's so many people who've been so good to me, so kind and so helpful, and I have so little energy to respond a lot of times, and so it really, I have one friend who sent me a card like every week for months, and it was just so lovely to get that and not feel any pressure to respond, but just, you know, she would let me know that she was thinking of me and with me, and many people did that by email or left me phone messages. And so, the thing for me is, and this may be very different for your friend, in the beginning, I didn't need that much, really, or I didn't know what I needed, and that's part of the process for me, where if someone has a diagnosis that's more clear-cut, with a more straightforward kind of treatment protocol or something, if she's going into chemo, then she may have more specific needs that she can tell you, you know. But it wasn't like that for me. I just kind of needed to know people were there, and people really let me know that. And the Caring Bridge site has just been wonderful for that. I love that. Yeah, I don't know, I wish I had something more specific to tell you. It has so many different faces, you know, cancer. It really is a completely different disease, I think, for different people. Yeah.
Have you pursued alternative health care?
Yeah, I have, and I am doing more and more of that now. This Dr. He that I referred to is a doctor of Chinese medicine, so I go to her for acupuncture and herbs, and she's been just a godsend. Because a lot of the symptoms that I have are the sort of vague, diffuse, I don't know quite what the word is. They're symptoms that Western medicine can't do much for. And so that's been very helpful. And plus, she's just got this tremendous spirit that is really uplifting. So, and then I'm just kind of starting to explore some other kinds of body work. Seeing someone who does, I don't even exactly know, craniosacral and a kind of a variety of things like that. Yeah, but I'm, that's where a lot of my, I think that's probably where I'll get some relief more than from Western medicine. There just, there isn't that much there. Yeah.
I'm so excited to hear you had a creative process bubbling right now. Can you say anything more about that?
Thanks. Yeah, I'm working on, I just am almost done with another, yet another revision of the novel I've been working on forever. So I'm getting ready to send that out again, trying to find an agent for that. And then I've just started working on another one, another novel, so that feels really good. It feels like, it's healing, I think. Yeah, thank you.
It sounds like you're doing pretty well with keeping your spirits up and so forth. Mm. Do you struggle at all with depression? Or?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I guess, but I struggle more with kind of really acute, like not, it's not sort of chronic depression, but I go into despair sometimes, or I just more frequently I just get really scared, and or really sad.
Do you use the practice with that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I've really been trying to sit with all of this. Yeah. And thank God for this practice. Yeah.
I commend you on so many levels. The one that just jumped out at me was when you kind of took a look at the whole picture when you were dealing with the democracy. And knowing that they're in a position that's probably not paying much. It's so chaotic in the first place. And to have all the answers for you is it's pretty hard for them. I think the whole world needs a lot more of that.
Compassion, you mean? Yeah. Amen. Yeah. Thank you. Could you guys hear that? He was talking about the bureaucracy and sort of recognizing that that they're just doing the best they can in this terrible situation. I hope I didn't give the impression that I always felt compassionate toward them, because that's really not true. Yeah, I mean, I am right. I try to did a lot of metta practice while I'm on hold with, medical assistance. Oh, they have the worst music.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is So thank you so much, Rini.
Thank you.
For sharing your
thank
heart.
Thank you all for coming out. Good to see you all.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.